When it's time to scale your business, it's time for Shopify. Get everything you need to grow the way you want. Like, all the way. Stack more sales with the best converting checkout on the planet. Track your cha-chings from every channel, right in one spot. And turn real-time reporting into big-time opportunities. Take your business to a whole new level. Switch to Shopify. Start your free trial today.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn. Thanks for joining us for episode 20, Golden Promises Broken. Tonight, we're on the case in Boca Raton, Florida, 45 miles north of Miami. The city that is now a major tourist destination was still shedding its roots as a farming community when high school sweethearts Cindy Rediker and John Futch mysteriously vanished. Their disappearance sent a wave of fear across the Sunshine State and launched a team of investigators on a heartbreaking search for answers. January 5th, 1978. It was just about dinner time on a cool Boca Raton evening when police got a frantic phone call reporting that two popular high school students, John Futch and Cindy Rediker, had gone missing.
They were seen at the high school at noon, and they had permission from their parents to go off campus to celebrate their 11-month anniversary.
The teenage sweethearts had planned a romantic picnic lunch and were due back at school before the final bell. But neither Cindy nor John had returned. John's sister, Lynn Walco.
We knew something was drastically wrong when he didn't show up for football practice. We were frantic then.
Cindy's family was also in a state of panic. The high school's head majorette had a lawn full of students waiting for her. Cindy's sister, Tammy Berkland.
She did not come home for her baton twirling lesson, and she never missed that. And my parents knew right away something was wrong.
Before calling the police, the two families checked with each other and the teenager's friends, hoping for an explanation.
We were calling all his friends, the Redikers, all the kids that were close on the football team, to find out where they could have gone.
No one had seen them, and no one seemed to know where they had gone for the picnic.
We didn't know where to look. We weren't sure where to even begin to search for them.
Despite the family's fears, police weren't worried. They were certain both kids would be home soon.
The patrolman that initially responded didn't know John and Cindy at all.
They said, we need to give a little bit of time. You never know. Sometimes kids will run away. And I remember my dad saying, that did not happen. There's no way that neither Cindy or John would do something like that.
My mom was absolutely frantic. And she said adamantly, no, this would never happen. They don't do these kind of things. He's always home when he's supposed to be.
Both families began their own search for the missing teens.
We were out in cars searching for them all night long. We went down every driveway, every possibility between the high school and home, searching areas where the car could have broken down or something could have happened. Maybe they're stuck. We didn't know.
But after a few hours had passed, panic set in.
We knew. Something is wrong. They should be home. Where could they be?
Early the next morning, police began to take the case much more seriously. A call from a power company worker had led them to a submerged car in a nearby canal.
The car was discovered by a utility worker. He was on the top of the pole, and he looked over and he saw the outline of the roof of the car.
Police quickly realized it was John's green Pontiac under the water.
It was in a service canal way off the road, so nobody would see it.
When officers looked through the windshield, there were no signs of John nor Cindy. But Detective Jim Rendell dismissed the idea that the couple had been in an accident. There were no skid marks on the roadway. In fact, all of Rendell's instincts told him that someone had intentionally sent the car into the canal.
Cops mostly always think the worst. Nobody puts a car in a canal. Except bad people.
An examination of the inside of the car added to the seasoned detective's theory.
The key was in the ignition, and it was still in drive, which tells it was driven straight in. In the trunk was tin foil that had some food particles left on it. I said, well, there's your picnic.
Based on the evidence, Rendell concluded that something terrible had happened to John and Cindy as they were finishing their romantic lunch.
I think they were probably already putting the picnic supplies back in the trunk when they were abducted.
While investigators weighed those disturbing possibilities, both John and Cindy's families were notified about the chilling discovery.
That just changed everything. The panic became just absolute wailing in the house.
I would say that was the point where we realized this is something really bad and that we probably will never see Cindy again.
Detective Rendell feared the same thing. And he knew if there was any hope of finding John and Cindy alive, it would be a race against time.
Most any investigator would tell you the first 72 hours is the most important period. We got to get on this now.
As police desperately searched the area for a clue to the teenagers' whereabouts, their devastated families braced themselves for the worst.
We all knew it was bad. You always want that ounce of hope, but I knew better.
The possibility that John and Cindy might already be dead was simply too painful for their families to accept. Both teenagers had so much promise. 17-year-old John was a star athlete, loaded with charm and charisma.
He was just so full of life. Anything he touched was golden. He was a champion diver. He was a star football player. If he touched a baseball, it went out of the park. He could have gotten a scholarship in any one of those three sports.
He was solid rock muscle, just head to toe. He was really fearless. He wasn't scared of nothing or nobody.
16-year-old Cindy was just as talented. The baton twirler led the school's marching band.
She was a very loyal person, and she was a lot of fun. Cindy was head of the majorettes, which was a big deal back in those days. And, you know, you got to lead the band out on football games, which was a big deal in South Florida.
Beautiful girl. Absolutely stunning. Sweetest personality. We loved her. She was just beautiful, inside and out.
Together, John and Cindy seemed like the perfect couple.
I remember Cindy saying to me, I'm going to end up with John. She felt that strongly about him. They were very, very close.
You know, the football player and this beautiful blonde twirler, they were like everybody's dream come true. And they've had a huge following of friends that adored them both.
As Detective Rendell searched the area where John's car had been found, he hoped to discover a clue that might help police find the teenagers.
We were going through absolutely everything, just walking everywhere.
Divers also swam the full length of the murky canal, but found nothing. In fact, Detective Rendell was convinced that John and Cindy had never made it to the canal. Rendell believed whatever had happened to the teenagers started during the couple's picnic.
We didn't know where the picnic site was, but we knew they were on a picnic.
Police were desperate to find that location. Friends suggested that investigators look at the secluded spot where the couple had selected a Christmas tree just weeks before.
We went to that site. We were told that there was a banyan tree somewhere in the area that they had gone. And sure enough, we found some burnt charcoal ashes.
Police were convinced they had discovered the picnic site. Tire tracks were found that matched John's car, confirming that the detectives were right. Police asked the public to help them search the area the next morning. Detective Rendell was stunned by the turnout.
As I pulled up, I see 500 people, if not more. Everybody was there. They were full of hope to find him alive.
The community volunteers divided into groups and combed through the rough terrain.
I cannot believe the way that our community as a whole came together.
It was a very, very hot day, and all of a sudden, I remember these trucks coming out. A lot of the local stores were sending out drinks and food for all these people. It gave you faith in humanity. People cared, you know.
It was a good feeling.
Despite their exhaustive effort, police found nothing that advanced the investigation.
We were expecting to find all kinds of physical evidence. Whenever there's a crime, there's always evidence left behind. Always.
But not in this case. After a few days of searching, investigators were getting increasingly frustrated.
We're now on the third day. We're batting zero for leads to a suspect.
Detective Rendell wondered if there was something that had been missed. He went back to the canal to give it one last look.
I had returned to go through it again, hoping maybe somebody was there returning to the scene of the crime.
The investigator was intrigued when he observed what appeared to be an empty van parked alongside the canal.
I had a gut feeling, so I went to the van and stuck my face up to the windshield and looked in there. The first thing that I noticed was the back door had a lock in it.
The side doors were also bolted shut with padlocks, and the detective took note of the dirty blankets inside. The van looked to be equipped to commit a crime. The detective wondered if this vehicle had played a role in Cindy and John's disappearance, and he made it his mission to find out.
I sat on that van for about 3 hours, hiding.
The stakeout seemed to be a waste of time. But just as Rendell was leaving the area, he noticed the van's owner had finally returned.
As I was driving west, he was coming east. I turned around, pulled him over, told him to get out of the van.
The driver of the van was identified as 42-year-old John Sanderson, and a quick background check heightened Rendell's suspicions.
We found out he had a criminal history.
But that wasn't all. Sanderson immediately began to talk about the missing teenagers, and what he said to the detective raised red flags.
He said, "I know where the murder scene is. and I can prove it.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. These days, I'm all about quality over quantity, especially in my closet. If it's not well-made and versatile, I'm not interested. That's why I love Quince. Quince makes high-quality wardrobe staples using premium fabrics like European linen and lightweight cotton cashmere sweaters that are perfect for the changing seasons. And their new spring colors and prints are really great. They're versatile, well-made pieces that make getting dressed simple and pricing that actually makes sense. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markups or fancy retail stores, and everything is built to hold up season after season. Thousands of customers rate Quince 4.5 to 5 stars because these are pieces people actually wear and love. My Quince cashmere sweater has become a go-to. It's light enough for layering, but still feels luxe, and it doesn't cost nearly what I thought it would. Stop waiting to build the wardrobe you actually want. You don't need more options, just pieces that work. Right now, go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to wear it and love it. Now available in Canada, too. Don't settle for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/OTCpod. The detective was stunned. The police had not officially declared the case a double murder. He suspected that he was standing face to face with the man responsible for killing the missing teens. Then, Sanderson offered to bring the investigator to the location where he claimed he had seen the dead teenagers.
So I said, take me to it. And he starts walking and walking.
In the darkness, Detective Rendell followed Sanderson deep into the woods.
Probably a good 30 minutes. I'm getting a little more concerned. Of course, I have my gun.
Sanderson then pointed to leaves that appeared to be covered in blood.
He said, this is where they were murdered.
And the detective saw disturbing evidence of the crime just a few feet away.
Ground was scuffed up. Over here is an organ. Looked like a human organ.
The veteran officer contacted his department immediately. Investigators collected the disturbing evidence from the wooded area, not far from where the teenagers had their picnic. Forensic experts quickly began processing the scene.
The serologist examines it and says, animal organs, red paint.
Shockingly, police learned that John Sanderson had staged the scene by painting the leaves red and planting the animal organs.
It turned out he had mental illness. He had a lot of problems.
John Sanderson's entire story was nothing more than an elaborate hoax by an attention seeker. Detective Rendell was furious.
What went through my mind was, how dare you waste my time?
The setback was disappointing, but investigators continue to do everything possible to generate new leads. Cindy's sister, Tammy Berkland.
You couldn't go anywhere without seeing the posters with the reward, without having people saying, I went out 2 days ago and searched.
But as the days slowly passed without answers, the teenagers' families were forced to face their darkest fears. John's sister, Lynn Walco.
Not knowing is the worst part.
I had nightmares of him being stabbed or drowned or shot or choked or beaten. I didn't know what happened. Every night was a different nightmare.
We were paralyzed. You know, what do you do? Do you have a funeral service? Do you just keep thinking maybe they're going to come back, even though you know in your heart they're not going to?
Investigators were also crushed by the lack of progress.
It's dispiriting. Leads that led us nowhere. Time wasted on attention getters.
Then, 2 months after the couple had gone missing, police finally got the grim news they had been bracing for.
Bodies.
Human remains had been discovered just a half mile from the picnic site. A man named Michael Schindel had stumbled upon them while walking his dog in the woods.
He had called in, said he found the bodies.
The detective drove out to the location.
There was a dirt road, half a mile long. They ran east from where the picnic site was.
The road ended near some railroad tracks, and there was a hill about 100 yards away.
I went over the hill, and there were two bodies. One obviously a girl, one obviously a boy.
Due to the condition of their bodies, neither teenager was recognizable.
The decomposition was so advanced, they spent days in the heat of the sun.
But based on the clothes they were wearing, Detective Rendell knew who they were.
After I looked at the bodies, I just backed down the hill, the same tracks I came up, and walked over to the captain and said, "It's them."
The search for Cindy Rediger and John Futch had come to a heartbreaking conclusion. The crime scene revealed many details of the gruesome mystery. But the most obvious was how the two teenagers had been killed.
Gunshot wound to the head.
Detectives theorized each victim had been shot at least twice. 5 22 caliber shell casings were recovered from the scene. Dental records revealed what investigators already knew. The victims were John and Cindy. With a heavy heart, Detective Rendell shared the news with both families.
38 years ago, still in my heart, they were just such really strong, good people.
The teenagers' loved ones will never forget the heart-wrenching moment when they heard John and Cindy had been found murdered. John's sister, Lynn Walker.
The same feelings of when they first went missing are back. Anguish. The world is a bad place. Who could do this and why?
Cindy's sister, Tammy Birkeland.
What was horrible was thinking, how did it happen? How long was she alive? How did she suffer? That was really hard for me.
More than 2,000 people gathered to pay tribute to the beloved teens.
The Boca High band played, and it was probably the worst sounding music you've ever heard in your life because they could hardly get through it. It was so hard. I still can remember walking down that center aisle with my family and my sister and just thinking, this is really the end. This is really the end.
But for police, it was only the beginning. As they searched for clues that might lead them to John and Cindy's killer, rumors began to swirl around the man who had found the young couple's bodies. Investigators quickly tracked down Michael Schindel and pressed him for details about how he had come to find John and Cindy.
My suspicions grew when he said he was out there collecting scrap metal with his dog. Just didn't make sense to be out in this wide open, white sandy field looking for scrap metal. There wouldn't be any scrap metal out there.
Rendell believed it was much more likely that Schindel was a killer who wanted to relieve himself of a terrible burden.
They're feeling guilty. They wanted to be discovered. It's the nature of the beast.
More red flags about Schindel went up after a convenience store owner contacted police. She recognized the man who found the two teenagers from a disturbing encounter she had had with him in her store.
He'd been in there 2.5 weeks prior to the bodies being found.
Schindel brought several items to the register when out of nowhere, he began ranting and raving about the missing teenagers.
He was all hyped up, talking about the homicide, talking about the murders.
But right after mentioning that still unknown detail, he suddenly bolted out of the store, leaving everything he was about to purchase on the counter.
That added to our suspicion.
Detectives asked Schindel about his whereabouts in the hours leading up to the couple's disappearance. His answer was not what police expected.
He said he was out of town on those days that the abduction and murder took place.
Police were able to verify his alibi. And once again, the investigation was back to square one. But those working the case refused to give up.
Assistant State Attorney Ann Vitunek.
These officers worked sometimes 24 hours in a row. They were dead tired. And they just kept working because they wanted to find the killers of Cindy and John. It was a very, very difficult case to investigate. The police officers were just relentless.
Assistant State Attorney Ann Vitunek understood the frustration investigators felt as they followed up on every tip called into the hotline.
There were leads from all different avenues, taking them on wild goose chases. But none of those leads panned out.
We got 100 to 200 leads. They were overwhelming, but I'm glad they called in. Any homicide detective would rather people call in than not call in. Let the detective make the decision whether it's a good lead or a bad lead.
The rigorous investigation seemed to be going nowhere.
I'd say we were kind of stagnated at that point, going back over everything, re-interviewing everybody, searching for something solid.
While police were hunting a sadistic killer, shaken local residents were living in fear.
I think it was a loss of innocence for Palm Beach County. And I think the fact that Cindy and John were murdered really woke the community up that the violence was not just in the bad areas of town, it could be anywhere.
You were really frightened because this person is still running around. And you're thinking, who else is he doing this to? This is not a person who belongs on this earth. We wanted this person found. We wanted them out of society.
3 years passed, and as Detective Rendell approached his retirement, he realized he was no closer to finding John and Cindy's killer than he had been on the day the couple went missing. It was a crushing blow for him
and the two families. Over the years, John and Cindy's loved ones had developed a close bond with Detective Rendell. John's sister, Lynn Walco.
He became part of our family. He was our advocate. He was our strength. He was our hope. He was the good guy that we could count on. Still is.
Then, on the eve of his departure from the sheriff's office, a tip came in that sounded very promising. An off-duty security guard named Tony Vitani was selling pit bull puppies from his home when he got information that he wanted to share with investigators.
Tony Vitani advertised pups for sale in the paper. And the person responding struck up a conversation when he saw his uniform.
Detective Lou Sessa.
He asked Tony Vitani, he said, are you a police officer? He said, no, I'm a security guard. And he said, do you know anybody in the sheriff's office? And he said, yeah, I know a lot of people there.
The man told Vitani that he wanted a dog because he was afraid of one of his relatives. And then he offhandedly mentioned why.
He says, oh, and by the way, you know, the Boca Raton High School kids, he's responsible for that.
He said that his brother-in-law had killed Cindy and John.
Vitani was stunned. After the man left, he contacted the authorities. Tony Vitani told police that the man they were looking for was Adam Herrera. That name struck a chord with Detective Lou Sessa. He had recently helped put the 19-year-old behind bars for sexual battery.
Adam Herrera had abducted a young female from the Boynton Beach area. He pulled a knife on her within 50 yards of where John Futch and Cindy Redeker were discovered.
The woman said she was abducted and taken to the remote location. During the attack, she begged for her life.
She had a good suspicion that she was going to be murdered.
The woman's description of threats Herrera had made during that vicious assault now seemed critical.
Herrera told her that he had raped women in that area before and that there had been bodies discovered in that area.
Detective Sessa believed that the statement Herrera made to the young woman had implicated him in the double murder. But he knew investigators would need a lot more evidence if they were going to arrest him for the crime.
The sheriff said, put all the investigators together and work on this at once. And that's exactly what we did.
Investigators tracked down Adam Herrera's brother-in-law, a man who had given the tip to security guard Tony Vitani. But he wasn't willing to go on the record with his statements.
He says he was under the influence of narcotics when he made these statements.
He said that he didn't know anything about the case and he didn't want anybody to hurt his family. So investigators realized that he just wasn't going to talk about it.
But detectives did find someone who was willing to talk. A woman who had spent years terrified of Adam Herrera. His wife, Gloria. With her husband already in jail for sexual battery, Gloria Herrera now felt safe enough to share what she knew about the murders with police.
When he was finally arrested, it was just a relief for her. That was her way out.
Gloria claimed on the day the teens went missing, her husband ran into their home in a panic.
He told his wife, we're leaving. Don't pack. Let's just go.
Gloria said her husband frantically explained that he had just witnessed a murder committed by a family friend named Arnulfo Sanchez.
He told his wife he was with Sanchez, and they came upon these two kids, and that Sanchez had killed the girl. He said he didn't do it, but he's in trouble, and they needed to get out of the area, and they did. They fled the area for a year.
She was afraid of him. Didn't come forward. Scared he would kill her, too.
On the Case, the podcast, will continue in a moment. Detectives researched the whereabouts of Herrera and Sanchez that day. They learned that both men had been working near the picnic site where John and Cindy disappeared. Detective Lou Sessa.
Sanchez and Herrera were temporary workers at Capella Farms.
Sanchez moved to Texas after John and Cindy disappeared. Investigators located him in San Antonio, where he had been picked up on burglary charges.
Sanchez was a petty criminal. Burglary, larceny, nothing major, nothing violent.
In the interrogation room, detectives asked Sanchez about the murders. They were stunned by his response.
He confessed to it. He said he was glad it was over. It bothered him.
Sanchez gave investigators a taped statement in which he described how he and Adam Herrera had stumbled upon the two teenagers while they were bird hunting after work.
They walked into the woods pretty far, and they found John and Cindy lying on a blanket having a picnic. And they didn't say anything to them and walked further back in the woods.
Police theorized the teenagers were racing to pack up after they saw the armed men.
I think John and Cindy got scared.
But before the young couple could escape, Herrera and Sanchez were back.
Herrera pointed a gun at John and said, "You're going to take us for a ride."
Cindy stayed in the front seat. Adam Herrera got in the driver's seat. Arnulfo Sanchez was in the back of the car with John Futch. They drove away from that area, according to Sanchez, for about half an hour to the area where the bodies were eventually found.
They drove them to the remote area, and Herrera forced Cindy out of the car, up over a mound where he raped her.
Sanchez said he and John heard two gunshots. Then Herrera reappeared.
Herrera came up over the berm, zipping up his pants, and said to John Futch, "Go check on your girlfriend."
And as John turned to go run, Adam shot him in the back of the head. Then they drugged John to where Cindy was, and John was still showing some signs of life, and Adam shot him again in the head. And they covered him with leaves, and that's where they left him.
Following the cold-blooded double homicide, Sanchez claimed he and Herrera drove John's car into the canal and went their separate ways.
He never thought that Adam was going to kill the girl. And then after he heard the shots, he knew he was in for the whole nine yards. And then everything unfolded rather quickly.
Every indication was that it was a killing of opportunity and that they just happened to be nearby and they saw the two kids and they just acted.
Cindy and John were in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was cold, blooded murder. No reason for it.
Sanchez agreed to take a polygraph exam. He passed.
So we believe that Adam was the shooter. His background was quite harsh. A lot of sexual batteries.
Arnulfo Sanchez's confession was a major break for detectives.
It was huge that Sanchez made this confession and that it was under oath and on tape.
Still, investigators had no doubt that Sanchez's confession was designed to minimize his own involvement in the murders.
I think Sanchez was a willing participant. I believe that Sanchez was holding the gun on John. He knew the love of his life was being sexually battered on the other side of the hill. There's no way that that man would have stood there without being held at gunpoint.
Armed with Sanchez's statement, Detective Lou Sessa visited Adam Herrera at the Florida County Jail to charge him with two counts of murder.
When the detectives went to talk to him at the Palm Beach County Jail, initially I think he believed they were going to talk to him about a rape. When they said, no, we're here to talk to you about the murder of Cindy and John, that's when he got very nervous.
The biggest reward that I had was reading the indictments to Adam Herrera, telling him that he was under arrest for first-degree murder. That was the coup de grace, as far as I'm concerned. I truly believe he never thought he was going to get caught.
The investigator says he'll never forget Herrera's stone-cold expression.
Looking into his eyes is scary. Even for me. That dead-eyed stare of a killer that shows no emotion. But I got my point across. You're going to jail for an awful long time if you don't get the electric chair.
News of the arrests brought relief to the teenagers' families. But the details of the senseless crime only added to their pain. Cindy's sister, Tammy Berkland.
It was the why. Yeah, why would this happen? Why would anybody want to take the life of two young people who were just having fun?
John's sister, Lynn Walker.
The fear that he felt bothers me to this day. Nobody should have to die like that.
Prosecutors wanted both men to face the death penalty at trial, but they had concerns about the strength of their physical evidence.
There was no DNA evidence. There was no blood evidence. There was no semen evidence. The bodies weren't found for 3 months in the heat of South Florida. So it was really, really hard to get any real evidence in this case.
Even the ballistics evidence couldn't be verified, since police were never able to find the murder weapon. The state carefully weighed its options and ultimately decided to offer both men plea deals. Herrera pled guilty to two counts of first-degree murder, and he received a life sentence without the possibility of parole for 50 years.
Adam Herrera is a cold-blooded killer that should never see the light of day. He's a typical psychopath. He has no feeling whatsoever.
He was just an evil, filthy, sociopathic human being. And he deserved to die. But he got life imprisonment. Longest life sentence ever given in the state of Florida, by the way.
Arnulfo Sanchez pled guilty to two counts of second-degree murder and kidnapping.
I would have liked to have seen the death penalty, but I didn't question our prosecutors. Our prosecutors were absolutely fantastic. They knew what they had to work with, and I think it was the right decision.
Family members were satisfied by the outcome. But while they are relieved that Herrera and Sanchez are no longer a danger to society, they are all still haunted by both of the killers' actions in the courtroom. Neither one of them showed any signs of remorse.
That was probably the hardest thing, having to sit in that courtroom, and they were right in front of us. I could have reached out and touched them, and no remorse at all.
To this day, I have no forgiveness in my heart for him. Nothing. I hope every day that I go without my brother, that he's as miserable in jail as we are miserable on this earth without them. That's closure for me.
Lynn says if there's a lesson to be learned from her brother's terrible tragedy, it's that parents need to know where their children are at all times.
And I try to instill this in my kids. Children, let your parents know where you're going to be so they know where you are. You have to be safe.
The two innocent lives lost still haunt the investigators who worked so hard to bring their murderers to justice.
I never had the pleasure of meeting either one of our children. But I basically lived at their house for 2 years. And so you become a family member. You watch that family suffer. Why? Here we are almost 40 years later. Who knows what those two kids could have become in 40 years?
The memory of Cindy and John lives on in their family's next generation.
I have two daughters, and I see Cindy so much in my girls. The personality, the vibrancy, the sense of humor, the love of life. In my mind, I'll always think of her as 16. Even when I have dreams to this day, she's 16.
John Futch is honored by a young nephew that bears his name.
I have a son named after him. My firstborn son, Jonathan Gregory Futch. Just proud of what he accomplished in the 17 years that he was here. He lived a lifetime in 17 years.
But those who love John and Cindy also know there is so much more they would have accomplished. And the pain of what might have been lingers to this day. The simple words on John's gravestone reflect their senseless loss.
My mom put on there a golden promise broken. Because he was a golden boy. Could have done anything.
Arnulfo Sanchez, one of the men convicted of murdering Cindy Rediker and John Futch, died in prison in 1994. The man who police believe pulled the trigger, Adam Herrera, is still serving his life sentence. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.